Hey guys, how's things? It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. You been watching David Petraeus this morning? What a clown. America's greatest general. Hey, he lost more wars than any of y'all. Right? Like, he's got the highest bowling score. Wait, golf score. Yeah, bowling is the same way, right? Anyway. Yeah, welcome to the show. I hate Petraeus. I'm going to make fun of him here in a minute. But, yeah, I got lots of news to tell you about, lots of things to tell you, including that today on the show, Jonathan Landay is going to be here to talk about the war in Syria and the American and Russian role, the coordination between the Americans and the Russians on this issue. Are things finally changing? Before the declaration of the caliphate, the sacking of Mosul in 2014, that whole spring, I was interviewing every journalist I know or former CIA guy or anybody I could get my hands on who knew anything about it to talk about the likelihood of a real Islamic State being declared in the land formerly known as Iraqi Sunnistan, including Landay. Just check the archives right there in the months leading up to the thing. And then after it happened, you know, I was a little wondery. But Landay said, well, of course, they got to switch back to Assad now. Of course, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush had paid Assad to murder jihadists for us all along, even as Bush had plotted against him as well. But it was Obama who really followed through on that. And then the idea was that, well, yeah, I mean, back in the jihadists against Assad never really made sense at all, but it sure as hell doesn't make any sense, nor can you get away with it politically after the rise of the Islamic State, right? But then, no, here we are. Not that I'm saying America should be switching sides to Assad. Just, yeah, Landay seemed to think that that would be the inevitable conclusion, because what are they going to do? Keep backing the jihadists even after the declaration, not just of an Islamic State, but the caliphate? With its leader claiming to be ordained in the Quran and all of that? Man. So anyway, now here we are. It's been another year and a half since then. And the Russians are intervening, and everybody in D.C. is crying their eyes out about it. But Landay's reporting that Obama sees the writing on the wall here, and looks like he's going to some degree coordinate with the Russians against IS. Although, you know, I guess we'll see. Oh, well, and Al-Qaeda too? Real division of opinion at the Petraeus hearing. Man, my DVR is broken. I tried to rewind it, and it says, oh, you must be restarting or something, because you can't rewind function is broken, dude. Oh, man. There was John Kerry. It'll be on C-SPAN. It may already be on. Well, no, the hearing is still going. But if the hearing ends during the show today, I'll see if I can get the soundbite for you. John McCain crying his eyes out. ISIS isn't the threat. ISIS isn't the threat. ISIS aren't the ones dropping barrel bombs. It's Assad that's dropping barrel bombs. Like, man, really? Yeah, but it's ISIS and Al-Qaeda who claim Osama bin Laden. It's the al-Nusra front that still swears loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri. So who gives a crap about Assad? Oh, yeah, I mean, sorry, except for the Israelis. And the Turks and the Saudis. The Qataris. Well, they got business. John McCain. Does he even know what a traitor he sounds like? I swear, I thought he was going to start turning information right over to Ho Chi Minh in the middle of the damn Senate hearing. Here's the flight plans. Here's the bombing routes that we take. You want to put your anti-aircraft here, here, and here, okay? And please take it easy on me. End quote. John McCain. Remember when Donald Trump was like, John McCain, he's a chump. What makes him a hero? The fact that he crashed and got captured. And the whole establishment was like, oh, gasp. Oh, how can you insult a former government employee? How can you insult John McCain? And then the polls came back. Everybody just liked Trump even more. Then they did a poll. Do you all hate John McCain? And the poll results were 99%. We all hate John McCain. Left, right, center, extremists, moderate, fascists, communists, libertarians, conservatives, liberals, progressives, his family. Everyone hates John McCain. Hate him. If anything, we're glad he was tortured by the communists. Out of all the people dropping napalm on the North, he was the one who deserved it the most. He was the one who had already blabbed straight to the New York Times after he set his aircraft carrier on fire, gunning his throttle and knocking a bomb off the wing of the plane behind him on the USS Forrestal there. He then fled in cowardly terror while other men were burning to death. And the aircraft carrier almost sank. He then got on a helicopter and fled in cowardly terror to Saigon, where he met a New York Times reporter in the bar and explained, man, now that I've seen what napalm does to a person, I just don't think I can do this anymore. And then he went up there and he did it more, dropping napalm on women and children. You know, like, because fighting age males, they love dying that way. You know, no problem there. But women and children, he went and he burned them to death with jellied gasoline after he had reflected very sincerely to a New York Times reporter just how horrible it must be what I'm doing to these people. And then he kept doing it. And all of D.C. was shocked, absolutely shocked, that the Republican rank and file hate John McCain. Really? The Republicans have always hated John McCain. He runs a fascist beer cartel. Oh, he married into a fascist beer cartel in Arizona, so he has money. Whatever other, you know, special interests make sure to secure his seat. But the people of Arizona hate his guts. And Lord knows the people of America hate his guts. The right wing, they like him for being a warmonger, but they hate him for being a Democrat on every other issue. And the Democrats hate him because even though he's a Democrat on every other issue, he's the worst warmonger in Washington, D.C. And they like to pretend that they're a little bit better than that. John McCain. I swear, you should have heard him. I'm going to get this soundbite for you. ISIS isn't the problem. ISIS isn't the problem. It's Assad that's dropping barrel bombs. Yeah, he's dropping barrel bombs on ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And yes, he is killing civilians, but most of the civilians are rallying to him. Rallying to the state. Why? The same reason Americans rallied George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He's fighting Al-Qaeda for us. Oh, supposedly. I mean, in both cases, they're actually empowering Al-Qaeda. But anyway, John McCain, what a joke. And David Petraeus, too, he stuck by his guns. And I haven't been able to watch the whole thing that's been going on and on, but he says, yes, he wants to split off moderate Al-Qaeda fighters from the extremists of al-Nusra. So he's saying, no, I don't want to ally with their leadership. I'd rather kill them, but I want to hire all their ground troops to work for me to fight against Assad and ISIS. Even though at the same time he did admit, or in another breath, I guess, he did admit that unless we know who's going to replace Assad and the Baathist regime there, everybody needs to cool their jets here. Because imagine that in a hearing in the Imperial Senate in Washington, D.C., they're actually grappling. I mean, other than John McCain, they're actually grappling with the fact, as he put it, as I've been trying to tell you, things in Syria could get worse, much worse. Much worse. And he didn't really elaborate, but what he meant was, if our side wins, then all the ethnic minorities will be butchered to death. That's what he meant. If America gets its way, and Israel and Turkey and Saudi get their way, the Druze, the Christians, the Shiites, the Alawites are all going to be put to the sword. Or will become Germans. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I kind of miss the chaos days when I could let the music play for a little while, you know? I like these guys. Anyway. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Enough about Syria for now, because both interviews today are about Syria. Jonathan Landay on what's going on. Adam Johnson on what has been going on. And in fact, yeah, there's a bunch of things I gotta ask Landay that are then, you know, gonna be part of the discussion with Adam Johnson as well, I think. But so that should be pretty good. But so I better go ahead and move on to other subjects and try to get them covered for you here. Tonight, it's another episode of Eye on the Empire with myself and Jeff Tucker. That is at liberty.me at 8 Eastern Time. 8 Eastern Time, 7 Texas Time. Eye on the Empire with myself and Jeffrey Tucker. And we are going to be talking about the boom and the bust and foreign policy. And, yeah, all that kind of stuff. If you know it, you know it. If you don't know it, you'll really like it. And also we're going to talk about, I think, his essay about Rand Paul that I agree with the conclusion, but I completely disagree with the substance of it. So maybe we got to talk a little bit about that. I don't know. I got an email from a guy saying, man, just get over it. Rand Paul, he's another Republican, so just forget it. Don't talk about him anymore and just do other stuff. But the thing is about it is I can't help it because of the level of blown opportunity here and the fact that it's really not completely and totally too late yet, although, you know, pretty much. I don't know. Yeah, it is. I mean, the truth is that the people who say that he secretly really is just like his dad and he just has to play more conservative, they're really wrong. He really is more of a conservative and much less of a libertarian than his father. And that is the real Rand. And it's a fatal flaw. Conservatism is a horrible, bankrupt, hypocritical ideology, mostly of just violence and dishonesty. There's not much else to it left. Just nationalism and stupidity. His father, as Dan Sanchez wrote in his previous article, the one before today's at antiwar.com, one of his father's greatest achievements was in explaining that history didn't begin on September 11th and that previous policy of bombing Iraq for a decade leading up to that attack had engendered it, and that is one of the issues where Rand has decided he's better off politically for his own ambition's sake if he throws his father under the bus. And not only does he throw his father under the bus, he throws such a hugely important truth under the bus. You know, as part of Jeff Tucker's article is how, well, geez, he said a couple of anti-war things in the debate and it only hurt him. Yeah, but that's because that's the first time he ever said it. Nobody believes him. He didn't have a Giuliani moment where he said something brave and true. He didn't get up there and say, listen, I'm sick and tired of you people demonizing Muslims. All right. You want to talk about, you know, terrorism and Islam and foreign policy. Islam mandates defensive war. And America has been waging aggressive war over there. So if you want to say Islam makes them do it, only in the same sense that your American patriotism makes you fight. Well, not that Republican actual politicians fight, but, you know, sometimes their sons do, rarely, but they make other their neighbors' sons. You know, hell, somebody attacks New York City, you got Californians, Texans, kids from Kansas and Michigan, all go sign up to go and fight. It's the same damn thing. That's why they fight us, because we fight them. Ever since Jeb Bush's father ruined everything. So stop demonizing Muslims, you pigs. Now that would be a Ron Paul moment for Rand. But he wouldn't dare. In fact, when he was anti-war in the last debate, what was he playing? What was he doing? What had happened? What had happened was nobody up there knew he was anti-war. Nobody remembered what his position was on Iraq War II. And so Trump says, yeah, you and me, Carson, we were the only ones up here smart enough to be anti-war. Everybody else was a dumbass like Jeb Bush's brother. And Rand had to cry and play catch up. I'm anti-war too. I'm anti-war too, he said. And why? How could Rand Paul have possibly been in that position? Because he's a punk ass bitch who has given away any pretense of being anti-war years ago. He's been horrible on Iran. He voted for Iran sanctions in the name of supporting diplomacy, and then he opposed the diplomacy. The perfectly good deal that he came out against, the one his father supported unequivocally. He blames radical Islam, not Bill Clinton murdering people, for causing September 11th. You know, because the simple truth that the lady he wants to be his opponent in the general election, that her and her husband's previous administration was what got us into this mess in the first place, even before Jeb's brother tripled that catastrophe, even before she quadrupled it as Secretary of State. I mean, what's he going to do? Make a coherent argument out of that? That's why people loved his father, because he told the truth. There's a great article today. Well, it actually is great. There's a lot of value in it. It's by Frank Rich in New York Magazine about why Trump is such a big deal. It has all this insightful stuff in it. And the thing that people like about Trump is he's not a liar. Well, he's kind of a liar, but he doesn't seem like a liar. And he's, you know, basically he's telling you exactly what he says. He quotes Owen Wilson, the actor, saying, well, all the other politicians get up there and act. They get up there and say their lines. Trump gets up there and says what he wants. So it's at least interesting to watch. It seems honesty. It's a breath of fresh air in a room full of all dishonest people. And no one would even stop to think to say, well, except Rand Paul, he's kind of honest. No, he's not. He flip-flops all over the place on every issue. He's bad on Russia. He's bad on staying in Afghanistan. He's bad on the Iran deal. He wants to declare war on the Islamic State. And not in a way like Ron Paul did in 2002, where he made it clear in his statement that he would vote against it. But he was merely in the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House challenging the other members of the Foreign Affairs Committee. If you're going to vote for a resolution to let Bush declare war, then you should just vote to declare war yourself and take responsibility yourself like in the Constitution. That's not what Rand did last December. Rand said Obama's not doing enough. We should declare war and go to war and destroy the Islamic State. And he said, he followed up, we should promise the Kurds. I would, he says, as president, I would promise the Kurds a state of their own. Draw new lines. In other words, go to war against Iraqi Shiistan, our Turkish allies, I guess Assad and the Islamic State in Syria. Did I say Iran and Turkey and Azerbaijan and Armenia? They got some Kurds up there. Yeah, Rand will plunge us into a regional war. He says, for the Kurds. But he's way less interventionist than the rest of these guys, you know. He's bad on Guantanamo, too. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Oh, yeah, you know, I forgot to mention to you guys that that interview of me about the Iran nuclear deal at wakeupcallpodcast.com is now available. If you guys want to hear that, wakeupcallpodcast.com. All right, now to our first guest. It's our friend Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. Been doing some important journalism there. Hey, how's it going, Jonathan?
It's good to be back.
Very good to have you here. U.S. and Russia seek common military ground in Syria. You don't say.
Indeed. Strange developments in what is already a tragic situation.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that most people listening to this show have a pretty good grasp of who's on whose side here,
right.
Basically. America, Turkey, and our GCC allies on one side, and Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, and Assad on the other kind of thing. But then you got the Islamic State, and, you know, I remember we talked right after the declaration of the caliphate that, well, come on, they gotta switch back to Assad now, kinda, right? But they really haven't done that. But maybe now they are finally giving up on the idea of training up enough of these moderates to take on all comers in this country. And now that Russia's in the way, they can't possibly overthrow Assad anyway. So now they're just, if you can't beat them, join them again kind of deal.
Well, it's really hard to say. I think that this is an administration that can't really figure out what it wants to do or what it should do. One thing that we know is that the president came into office with a desire to disengage this country from its history of engaging in conflicts in the Middle East and other parts of the world, that it is usually the case that the United States has exacerbated and made worse. And after the invasion of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, I think the president decided that he wanted to try and change the way the United States addresses these conflicts. The problem is that in doing so, you create a vacuum and you open yourself up to criticism that you're going weak and apprehensions by your allies that you're going weak. And it looks like Mr. Putin is taking advantage of that in order to buck up Mr. Assad under the guise of going after the Islamic State.
Well, I'm not sure how much of it you saw. I imagine at least some of it, Petraeus' testimony this morning where, you know, he's even trying to teach John McCain, I think, that, you know, I mean, and he is saying we should be breaking off so-called moderate al-Nusra fighters. I guess we could get to that craziness in a minute. But at the same time, in another breath, he's saying, hey, look, regime-changing Assad without a good idea of what to do, what to replace his regime with, is not a policy that I can endorse, man. I mean, we got a real problem here, and he didn't say exactly what he meant, but we know what he meant when he said the violence there could get much, much worse, meaning if the Baathist regime falls, every member of those ethnic minorities, the Christians, the Shia, the Druze, the Alawites, have a death mark on their head.
Well, I think that that's exactly why the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has avoided getting deeply entangled in the Syrian quagmire. And if you remember, the idea of creating, arming, and training, quote-unquote, moderate forces was really not his idea, and he fought it for a while. He had a Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, now running for president, who was pushing that idea. He had a Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who was pushing that idea. And he had a CIA director, David Petraeus, who was pushing that idea.
Panetta.
Panetta.
But I think it
was pushing that idea.
I think it was Panetta at defense and Petraeus at CIA at that time.
Right.
But it is hard to keep it all straight, I admit.
I think she was very much in favor of this as well, as was John McCain and other hardliners on the Hill. And you saw the president eventually agreeing to this, but it was a program that was very badly troubled by a whole different, a bunch of different reasons.
But you're only talking about the DOD program now, right? Because you,
right,
you have reported on the CIA program for years now.
Yes, indeed. Right? But that's being run out of the South, or originally was being run out of Jordan. And involve mostly people in southern Syria, although those people are trained, are now, my understanding is, dispersed around Syria, but haven't made a great huge dent in either the Assad regime, let me back up. They haven't made a huge dent in their primary purpose, which is to defeat the Islamic State. Now, we're not sure at this point to what contribution the CIA-trained fighters have made to the loss of territory that Assad has been suffering in recent months. But for the most part, the major actor in that was the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra.
Mm-hmm.
And that then opens up a whole another question about the Russian involvement. Putin claims that they want to go after the Islamic State, but what would stop him from going after other groups, including groups that are affiliated with the United States?
Right. Well, real good question. And what the hell is America doing being affiliated with any of these groups in the first place when we see right here in the Telegraph today, the U.S. trained, that is DOD trained, Division 30 rebels, the ones that weren't killed or captured, signed up with al-Nusra and gave up all their guns and all their pickup trucks and everything that the U.S. had given them. And they're now, of course, turned right over to al-Nusra. And that's the thing, is it's not just the trained. And I guess I would ask you, ballpark estimate, best your knowledge, how many the CIA has trained there in Jordan. But it's not just that, right? It's the money and the coordination with the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris for years now to just help and make sure this all keeps going.
I think the figure that I've seen in the open in the New York Times was 5,000.
All right. But now the entire CIA op, again, though, includes more than just training these guys. It's coordinating with our allies this whole time, too, right?
In theory, I think one of the original reasons for that, or purposes of that, of the CIA program, and I've done some reporting of this on this in Jordan, mm-hmm. was to help prevent a spillover of the conflict in Syria into Jordan, and across the border into Jordan, across the border into Israel. I think originally the purpose was to sort of secure the southern border of Syria to prevent, as I said, a spillover of the war and prevent Nusra or Islamic State from being able to infiltrate and carry the war across the borders.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously gotten bigger than that. Again, we don't know what the impact has been because it is a classified program. We know that the impact of the Pentagon program is nil. One of the things that's really interesting to me is that the Russian deployment, the intervention by Putin, suggests that the Assad regime and Assad himself are far more shaky,
mm-hmm.
are in a far more shaky situation than had been appreciated. And I think if you look at the composition of the Syrians who are pouring out into Europe, I think a lot of those people may have, in fact, been, you know, this middle class, educated middle class, who were the core of Assad's supporters for so long, and have basically given up, and are without hope of being able to remain in their native land, and are therefore heading to Europe. And so, take all that together. Plus, one other aspect.
Wait, hold the aspect. We'll be right back, y'all, with Jonathan Landay, McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. We're talking about America, Russia, the jihadists, the Syrian civil war. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking about the Syrian civil war, so-called civil war, foreign war, and Russia, etc., with Jonathan Landy from McClatchy, D.C. And now, here's a couple of things you need to know. Time flies really fast. And I know that a lot of listeners to this show are pretty young and don't remember a lot of the same things I remember. So let me tell you a thing. Jonathan Landay and his buddy Warren Strobel, far above and beyond any other mainstream newspaper reporters in this nation for Knight Ridder newspapers back in 2001, in italics there, 2 and 3, told the real story of how Cheney and his Gestapo office is what Powell called it, the separate government of the AEI neocons inside the Bush Jr. administration, how they lied us into war. And how pissed off the rank-and-file CIA analysts were at how twisted all the data was and everything else. And so that's not just to give you credit, Jonathan, because I've given you credit a lot of times. It's to tell the people that they can go to McClatchyDC.com, and then you just search and make sure and add 2002, 2003 to Landay's name. And they, when they bought Knight Ridder, they did a good job of importing all those articles. They're all there at McClatchyDC.com. It's a very important history lesson for you there. First to break the existence of the Office of Special Plans, and on and on and on. So, speaking of which, the Office of Special Plans, your buddy, Julian Borger, who wrote an article called The Spies Who Pushed for War, that's very important, and talked about Ariel Sharon's war and lying us into war in Iraq in 2002 and 3. He has a piece here about how Russia tried to negotiate a deal at the beginning of 2002 to get Assad to step aside. So I'm sorry, I'm remembering now that you're in the middle of a statement when we got stopped for the break. But we got to come back to 2012 in a second here.
We can try, yes. But my other point was this, that the other reason I think that the Russians, that Putin decided to intervene, is because who is the other supporter, main supporter of Assad? It's Iran and the revolutionary Iran, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, and their proxy force, Hezbollah. Well, they've been tied down in an offensive near the Lebanese border since June and have been making very little progress. And Hezbollah may, in fact, be taking unacceptable casualties. And so I think not only is has Assad been losing territory, and he has admitted he has serious manpower problems, but I think Iran and Hezbollah have run into a serious problem over by the Lebanese border, and I think that may have had something to do with the Russian decision as well.
Yeah. Well, and here, you know, same story again, better segue to the story, instead of OSP. Russia says Syria's Assad is ready to share power. And when Russia says that, Syria listens, and so do the rest of us, right? So not
well,
only
yeah,
did they
but
offer...
I don't know if the Iranians are listening, because they've made clear that Iran, that they still see Assad as the guy, as the man. You know?
Yeah. Interesting. You know, I know a Syrian Druze who says that everybody hates Assad himself, basically. But what they support is the Syrian state and the Syrian military that is protecting them from the crucifiers and the head choppers.
Yeah, I
Simple
think that's
as that.
Right. I mean, I was in Syria twice last year on visas. You know, I went in on the government side, and that's exactly what I found, that, you know, you don't necessarily like Assad, but what you don't want is our foreign jihadis. And let's not forget, the Islamic State is dominated by Iraqis and foreigners coming to your country which was, you know, as bad as the Assad dictatorship was, it preserved Syria as a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional country, and imposing these, you know, these strict interpretation, perverted interpretation of Islam. And you know, I had a friend there who's a Sunni, and with a young son, and she said, you know, I don't want these. I like to drink. I like to smoke. I like to dance. I have a young son. I don't want these people coming into my country and telling us how to live. So I think that your Druze friend is absolutely right. I think a lot of Syrians don't necessarily, and I wrote a piece about this when I was there the first time. A lot of Syrians, I don't think, necessarily support Assad, but they do support preserving the nature of the Syrian state that they know, which is this sort of multi-confessional, multi-ethnic state.
Well, and there's not, correct me if I'm wrong, Lande, but is there another mustache waiting next in line, as Greg Palast would say, to replace him? Or not?
I don't know. That's the thing.
It seems like he's holding
so.
The state together. That's right. Why he's still there.
You know the expression, l'état c'est moi. I am the state. I think that's very much the case when we're talking about Bashar al-Assad.
But as you say in your article, America insists he has to go even before they'll negotiate.
But we're starting to maybe hear a little bit of flexibility on the part of the administration. You heard the Secretary of State, John Kerry, over the weekend talking about there can be no long-term role for Mr. Assad. Well, that's maybe heralding a bit of a change
in
administration policy. I don't know yet. But certainly, you know, and you had the Brits come out a couple weeks ago with a proposal that perhaps Assad should be allowed to stay on for the first 6 months of a transition. So already the European allies, you know, who are facing this huge influx of refugees, half of whom are Syrians, may be shifting as well to trying to find a more pragmatic political solution, because the one thing that is certainly right is that, at least as far as anybody I know is concerned, there is no apparent alternative at this moment to Bashar al-Assad, and that raises the problem of a potential power vacuum should he go, and there's no, you know, this was an interesting thing in former Yugoslavia, which I also covered. There was no designated successor to Marshal Tito, there was no one on whom sort of all the different ethnicities could agree upon as his successor. And I think that could also be a problem that they have in Syria.
Yeah, well, there's no alternative successor, obvious successor to take over Syrian
exactly.
Sunni stand from ISIS and Nusra other than
right.
Damascus either.
Right, right. And that's why I think the Russians went in because they understood that Assad may be in far more serious straits than we all appreciated, you know, that his grip on power was increasingly tenuous. And let's not forget there have been a lot of reporting about members of his own Alawite minority becoming disenchanted and disillusioned with Bashar because, you know, he's made a lot of promises about how he was going to win the war and expel these foreign jihadis and has failed to do so. And, you know, when I was there, I was meeting Alawites who had already done like two terms in the military and were being summoned back to do another term, and you know, the people who'd lost multiple sons and there was a feeling. I mean, I was getting the feeling that, you know, yes, people still sort of supported him, particularly among the Alawites, because there was no alternative, and because they really do face potential existential threat, even genocide, from the likes of the really crazy Sunni extremists like Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State.
Yeah, you just think about this story. If you take the fact that America is in on it and we're Americans and all that and leave that aside for a minute and just look at it, you know, like we're Kang and Kodos in space here and we're just looking down at what's going on here. Well, Syria has been invaded by al-Qaeda, backed by Syria and Turkey. And they got every right to kill as many of them as they possibly can. And these are the guys who knocked down our towers, who we hate more than anything, who used to just be a few hundred guys and were the excuse for America to turn the whole Middle East upside down in the name of them. And now we're on their side against the guy with the clean-shaven chin and the three-piece suit. And still,
well, I don't know that we are on their side. I mean, I haven't heard anyone beyond David Petraeus
Talked about all the guns and all the money ends up going to them anyway. I mean, there's 100 different YouTubes of al-Nusra shooting TOW missiles, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, come on. It's all America's been supporting the jihad.
We know they stole those. But yeah, I get your point.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's not very plausible deniability is basically what it is, right?
I
mean,
I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Anyway, listen, you do great journalism. I appreciate you coming on the show, Jonathan.
Absolutely. Anytime, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is Jonathan Lande. He is at McClatchyDC.com. This one is called U.S.-Russia Seek Common Military Ground in Syria. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Live here on the Liberty Radio Network. Hey, join up the chat room. I forgot to say that. Join up the chat room. Bunch of guys in there today. Hey, everybody. ScottHorton.org/chat. Or use your chat application. It's hashtag Scott Horton Show. IRC free node thing. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Okay, next up is Adam Johnson, who has written a ton of great stuff for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Fair.org. And this one is Down the Memory Hole. NYT erases CIA's efforts to overthrow Syria's government. So this is something that obviously just came up in the interview with Lande here, is all the focus on the DOD trained forces, some of whom just in the last couple of days have gone over to al-Nusra, as you could have predicted. But everybody's ignoring the CIA and the history of the last 4 years. Well, Adam Johnson is not ignoring it. He's reminding us. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing real good. Well, Lande says, as far as he can tell, the CIA trained forces, he goes with the New York Times number of about 5,000 and says, as far as he knows, right, and he even went and saw these guys in Jordan at one point, that they're basically border guards helping keep the real terrorists out of Syria, out of Jordan and Israel. And that's basically the biggest role they played. But then again, of course, as we talked about, a lot of money and a lot of weapons have gone through these moderates, so-called, these American-trained and picked guys, to the guys who were actually, perfectly happy to die fighting, and that would be the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State, of course. But anyway, so I guess let's start with that. Your best information from all the different journalism that you've looked at over this, how many people do you think have gone through the CIA training program in Jordan and or elsewhere?
It's impossible to know. I know that the Daily Beast and the New York Times use the number 5,000. I know the Washington Post has a source of the CIA that say it's 10,000. Usually, I don't really think the CIA has an incentive to overemphasize, nor do I think they have one to really underemphasize. So, and the more striking number to me is the $1 billion a year program. which is, by the way, not based on anonymous sources. It's actually based on documents the Washington Post has from the Edward Snowden leaks. Mm-hmm. And they sort of casually bury it in the piece, but it's there. It says, we know based on the Snowden documents that roughly $1 in every $15 of the CIA's official budget, and I stress official, went to to some activities in Syria, whether that's arms, training, or some other activity originally against Assad and now against Assad and more so, I guess, ISIL. So, you know, we don't know. I don't know. I'm not privy to the information. But all we can know is based on the reporting we know that there is a program. It has quite a bit of money spent on it, and that it has trained anti-Assad rebels and has, more specifically, in 2012, was helping arm and provide supplies for the rebels, the so-called moderate rebels. And, you know, you can see on social media, al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, ISIS, have posted pictures on social media of them holding American-made weapons, American-made supplies in Syria, which, of course, in Iraq, you could say they got them from the Iraqi army, but in Syria, that it, by definition, has to have come originally through the CIA and later through the DOD. So, you know, this isn't really a mystery. Mainstream media openly acknowledges it. I think what's debated, and I think it's debated fairly, is to the extent of the program and the efficacy of the program. Mm-hmm. What my piece says is I'm simply asking that we acknowledge it exists. And so far, a lot of the media coverage about America's efforts in Syria has completely omitted it from the record. And I'm simply saying we should at least acknowledge it. Now, if we want to debate how big it is, that's a different conversation. But so far, the New York Times, Reuters, Vox, the Associated Press have had these long form discussions of our history in Syria, and they've completely omitted it from the conversation, which to me seems intellectually negligent.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, especially when the New York Times piece you link to here, I'm just going to assume it's got to be the one by Sanger, right? This is
Peter
a different.
Baker.
Yeah, no, it was the Sanger piece. It was the Sanger piece from maybe even earlier. Where he says the arms are all going to the jihadists. Not that we're giving them directly to the jihadists, but again, you know, moderates sit on their fat asses in hotels in Qatar while extremists who don't mind dying are the ones out there doing the fighting. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that anytime you pump arms, and anyone can tell you this in the human rights world, but anytime you pump arms into a civil war, they're going to necessarily gravitate towards the more extreme elements. I think at one point some were even using the Orwellian term moderate extremist. I mean, unfortunately, it's the civil war that's been going on for 4.5 years. And unfortunately, in any situation, more extreme elements are going to rise to the top. I mean, again, imagine if there was a civil war in the United States. I think it's probably fair to say that the more hyper-religious, hyper-hardcore elements would probably be more effective at gauging war. So, you know, that's the logical conclusion of flooding arms into civil wars and why you probably shouldn't do it. So, yeah, invariably, more radical elements are gonna get those arms. Now, we know for sure that Al-Qaeda is now fighting alongside the FSA. This has been reported by even neoconservatives like Michael Weiss at the Daily Beast. This is not a new revelation. Now, they'll say it's a marriage of convenience, and I'm not going to dispute that. But at the same time, it's a law of averages. And the average on average, if you flood one side of a civil war that's aligned against I guess you could say more secular, more Shia elements, you're going to embolden and strengthen radical Sunni extremists. And that's what you've seen happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, and this is exactly the point. It's been going on for years. And even David Sanger, in my confirmation bias mode, even David Sanger at the New York Times warned us years and years ago that guns and money to the FSA equals guns and money to Al-Qaeda. I mean, come on. That's who's fighting this civil war is
yeah,
a bunch of bin Ladenites. And the FSA, they're head choppers and suicide bombers, too. They're not any more moderate than Al-Qaeda forces.
I'm willing to concede for the sake of argument, and maybe this is true, that there is, or especially in the early days, there was a legitimate sort of moderate secular force that did have more secular elements, even members of you know, people that defected from the military and the Communist Party that were more that were not by no means radical. I think as the war goes on, you see less and less of that, and I see less and less evidence for that. And I actually think there's kind of a third analysis that kind of less a lot of the pro-FSA crowd kind of compromised with, I guess, the my position, which is I do think to the extent there was an organic rebellion, it has been eroded and commandeered by both Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Contras, and also just radical jihadists that have come in from Iraq and from elsewhere. And so to the extent that it is real and does exist, I think it's just been completely overwhelmed by these other forces. And to, you know, that's not necessarily anyone's fault. It's just what happened. Well, I mean, it is someone's fault.
Yeah.
somebody wrote those checks, right? I mean, ISIS is the best paying army in the Middle East, and somebody's writing those checks, and that money comes from somewhere.
Yeah, and hey, look, Phil Giraldi published in Antiwar.com and the American Conservative Magazine in December of 2011, and it was already reported some other things, but he reported that Obama just signed a new finding authorizing the CIA to expand covert operations in Syria. That's the end of 2011. And,
yeah, I mean, Obama's handed a lot of this over to the CIA. He puts a lot of trust in the CIA. We know this from, obviously, his dealings with bin Laden and those types of things, that the power shifted from the DOD to the CIA. But again, I don't want anyone to think that this is purely an Obama thing. Actually, it's funny. I had a friend who, a little bit of a tangent here, but I had a friend who's, I guess, right-wing grandfather passed along my article in FAIR and said, look at this. The media's in bed with Obama. And I thought it was hilarious because he didn't know it was me. And I said, hey, email him back. Tell him I'm a Marxist, because I am, by the way. And tell him that it's not about Obama per se. It's about the New York Times is gonna kiss the butt of anyone in power, whether it's Bush or Obama. So I don't want it to think it's just Obama, but I do think Obama's the idea that Obama's hands off is totally bogus. I mean, the CIA
has signed on the dotted line and very well could have said no instead. Now we got to stop right there for a minute, but we'll be right back with more from Adam Johnson at FAIR.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the dang thing, man. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Talking with Adam Johnson from FAIR. And we're talking about the media blackout. We have the ridiculous farce of the paltry number of DOD-trained mythical moderates either kidnapped, killed, or immediately on their bellies swearing loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri and what's his name, Golani, the leader of Syria and al-Qaeda. And in the midst of all this coverage comes all this mythology that, yeah, Obama, the Ron Paulian isolationist, non-interventionist peacenik, hasn't done a thing in Syria this whole time because he's been so skeptical and reluctant. In fact, Lande even engaged in a little bit of that conventional wisdom, even though he's reported the exact opposite himself about all the CIA training this whole time. But there's a bit of truth in it, a kernel of truth in it, that they twist, which is that Obama, I don't think, has been reluctant to back al-Nusra. He has just had a goal, or, you know, their combined movement, however you want to splice it exactly. He just has a different goal in mind. He agrees, as Jody Ruderin wrote, quoting Israeli officials in the New York Times, the strategy is to bleed both sides permanently, not to overthrow Assad. If he wanted to overthrow Assad, he could have just carpet-bombed Damascus the same way he did Tripoli. But instead, he has gone about just weakening Assad, and as David Wormser put it in Coping with Crumbling States, expediting the chaotic collapse. That doesn't necessarily mean that he ever thought it was a good idea to completely overthrow the government, because That'll make him look bad. If Al-Qaeda rules Damascus and murders hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Shia and Druze and Alawites and Christians, so go ahead and just split the state into pieces, I guess. You know, it seems pretty obviously what's been the plan here.
I actually do think the actual policy is to overthrow Assad. I think sometimes a cigar is a cigar. And when the CIA and the White House and the State Department say the official U.S. policy is to overthrow Assad, and it's a program they've had on the books since 2006, 2007, when it was sort of spearheaded by Bush, I do think that's the end goal. I think it's an issue of political will. And I do think Obama, to his credit, has been far less, I guess, bellicose than, say, a Clinton and certainly a McCain would have been. I think that he does the bare minimum one can do when you live in a national security state and still remain relevant and, you know, not be harassed and undermined by his Defense Department, which he is right now to some extent, with all these recent revelations about him so-called cooking the books on ISIS. So I think relatively speaking, Obama is not as militant, but, you know, when you live in a national security state, it relative doesn't mean much to the people in Syria who are living in a civil war that's partially, and I stress partially, fueled by the United States.
Yeah. On the other hand, it'd be so easy. It's the same thing with, you know, how he could have won easily on Afghanistan in 2009 and opposed the surge then. Same thing here. All he has to do is tell the simple truth. Hey, look, Americans, there's a lot of things to not like about Assad, but here's one thing to like about him. It's the same reason Bill Clinton and George W. Bush hired him to torture jihadis for us for all these years. He's right. Against the jihadis. He shaves his chin every morning. He wears a three-piece suit. And he's against the bin Ladenites. And even though our allies, the Israelis and the Turks and the Saudis, want us to back the bin Ladenites against them, the bin Ladenites are the ones who knocked our towers down. And so I've decided as our president, that's against our interests. And the Turks and the Saudis and the Israelis are just going to have to deal with it. But
yeah.
How that would have been the end of that. Who could have argued with that? Even John McCain would have had to shut his fat mouth after that.
The military sort of, you know, it's nebulous when you talk about these things, but the military-industrial complex, the sort of powers that be, I don't think would have liked that. Again, the Al-Qaeda's only our bad guy when we need it to be. And otherwise, it's, I mean, again, look at what happened in Libya, which is a crime that people still haven't really been called to attest to. Right. And it's the same people that were doing it last time. You know, Nicholas Kristof and Maurice Slaughter, a lot of the ex-Clintonites in the State Department, they speak in a language of humanitarianism, but really it's just nonstop regime change. It's, if you don't fall within the capitalist neoliberal order, we send in the cruise missiles and you're toast. And that's what you see again.
Simple as that. And then again, back to the blackout. Here's a story that's been reported 10 million ways from Sunday. And in the age of Twitter and Facebook, and everybody knows about this. And how dare Zach Beauchamp try to pretend that this doesn't exist?
Yeah, it's weird. You
Is
know,
that how you I, say I, that? I hate that I'm, guy. Every article I've ever read by him has some horrible, evil, stupid war party lie baked in. Some ridiculous, unproven, fake, false premise.
He basically follows the State Department line to the T. It's very cartoonish. I mean, look, the guy's not very bright. He thought there was a bridge between Gaza and West Bank, which, if you've ever been to Israel, is like saying there's a bridge between, you know, Newark, New Jersey, and Brooklyn. It's ridiculous. But it's a bit of a cheap shot, but he does suck. The fact that you could write a 4,000-word piece and not mention the CIA program, at least in passing. Like, you get Nancy Youssef at the Daily Beast, who's actually a really good journalist. I mean, she does do a lot of propaganda because it's the Daily Beast, but a lot of what every time she writes about this, every time she mentions the CIA program, because like you have to mention it. It's the big 400-pound gorilla that this program existed. And again, we can debate how effective it was, but it existed. But for some reason, in the last week or two, there's been this really bizarre inability to mention it. Now, one of the reasons is that the program's still technically classified. So the White House, the State Department, the Congress can't really talk about it because it's classified. And so what you have is you have journalists that are basically doing official state journalism. Now, because the people they're talking to literally can't mention it, that's one of the reasons it doesn't make its way into the report. But the problem is that the media is not, at least in theory, subject to the same kind of restriction. So, you know, the fact that they wouldn't mention it is to me really bizarre and really notable, which I think is why my piece kind of struck a chord, because I'm simply pointing to the same, you know, outlet saying here, the New York Times reported
right.
it, Washington Post reported it, Reuters reported it, Der Spiegel reported it. This is not a mystery. Even John Kerry has tacitly acknowledged its existence a couple times. And so, but yet we have to run through this charade where we act like it never happened. And it's really weird to me, because I don't think you can have an honest conversation about what to do next in Syria or do anything at all in Syria without acknowledging what we've done so far. And the media has failed to do so.
Yeah. Well, and you got to give them credit, though, that the simplest of little kind of narratives win out over all this complicated truth. And as long as you have Hillary and Petraeus playing bad cop and saying Obama's not doing enough, then that's cover for whatever he does.
Yeah, and again, if the New York Times wanted to say that Obama did not back enough CIA rebels and Clinton and Petraeus thought he should do more, that's fine. Have that conversation. But when they say that it didn't happen at all, I mean, that to me, that's a memory hole. That is complete erasure of history. And the reason why they don't want that narrative is because then that begs the question, what have we done so far? And now we have to have that conversation. And that's a conversation they don't really want to have.
Right.
Because it's messy. It messes up the narrative.
Yeah. Well, but I have a real simple narrative about all this. George Bush turned all of Western Iraq into jihadistan, and then Obama spread it to Libya and Syria. It's both their fault completely. It's been reported a million ways. There's no denying any of it. And there's no denying why either. Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, yeah, that's right, because Israel wants to weaken Iran's position over here. And so, okay, good. Let's take Iran down a peg by getting rid of Assad or whatever. That's not even a secret.
That's partially it. It's also a proxy. It's also about the Hezbollah as well.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the last real threat to Israel in any meaningful way, because they're you know, unlike Hamas. Hamas is basically, you know, I mean, Hamas is incredibly weak. Hamas is not a real threat to anybody. But Hezbollah was the last military to actually defeat Israel. And so a lot of it, of course, has to do with that as well.
Yeah, it's all in the clean break. This is all about weakening Hezbollah, and you weaken Hezbollah by neocon logic, by overthrowing Saddam and then bringing chaos to Syria.
Yeah,
so it took a little while, but they're getting it done.
Well, what you want to get rid of is any competition in the Middle East to American and Israeli hegemony. And once you knock off Assad or weaken him to the extent he may as well be knocked off, and you effectively get rid of Hezbollah, then the only thing left standing is Iran. And then once they're gone, it's pretty much, I mean, that's it. That's complete hegemony. It's all puppet governments of NATO, and that's it.
You got it. All right, man. You know what? I've always loved fair ever since way back, and I ain't no Marxist.
You're in bed with Marxists.
No, I totally am. And I totally am because I only care about empire.
You know, I probably disagree with most of your stuff, but we have agreements when it comes to this kind of thing.
Of course. And you know, more importantly, the thing is about FAIR and before you ever started writing there either is that they don't do this kind of, oh gee, but I am kind of loyal to the Democrats, so let me fudge this a little bit or whatever. They're always just as good during Democrat times, whether it's Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, as they are during George W. Bush. And you can't say that about a lot of liberal outlets, but always really good and on point. And doing stories like this. Hey, don't forget about the CIA. It is very important work that you're doing there, Adam, and I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, y'all. That's Adam Johnson. He's at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. This one is Down the Memory Hole. New York Times erases CIA's efforts to overthrow Syria's government. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all. I'm sorry for beating a dead horse here, man, but damn, ain't it frustrating to you, America's Syria policy? It just drives me out of my mind. I mean, it's been like this forever, and I just can't stand it. And I don't think America should be backing Assad for the millionth time. I agree with Michael Scheuer. Michael Scheuer was on the Lou Dobbs show. Michael Scheuer is a very right-wing American nationalist conservative Catholic, former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, the man who gave Bill Clinton 10 chances to kill him, to kill Osama before George Bush ever had a chance to screw that up. He was interviewed on Lou Dobbs, and I say all that to introduce him. I'll continue introducing him. He's the kind of guy who, to him, humans that live outside of the United States, tough. If you happen to be near enemies of ours, we're going to explode you, and don't give a damn. Don't give a damn. You shouldn't be near people we want to bomb, then that's your problem. That is his take on it. Find the enemy, obliterate them, and use whatever firepower necessary to obliterate them, and then he wouldn't say more than that, but anybody else caught in that fire, tough. Absolutely tough. In other words, he's a former U.S. government employee in the national security state. And I say that to introduce him to you so that you understand. This guy's a Republican. And I don't mean like in the Republican Party, but I mean he's a conservative. If the Republicans were what they pretend they are, he would be one of them, if you understand what I mean. And he was on Lou Dobbs, and he was saying, America's back in Al-Qaeda against a guy in a three-piece suit with a clean-shaven chin, Lou. And this is crazy, and it's treason, and it's insane, and I almost can't even say it because it sounds so crazy, and it's horrible. And Lou Dobbs says, Jesus, I see what you mean. I never heard anybody actually explain it correctly before, but damn, Michael Shorey, you make a point there. And then he says, well, so should we be backing Assad? And before he says, yeah, kill them all, he goes, wait. No, we should not. And I'll tell you why. Because Assad is a horrible bastard and an evil killer and a Shia. And if we take his side, then we make the Islamic State look right about us. Look, again, it's the Americans, the Shia rejectionists, so-called, and the Zionists, the Christians, the Shia and the Zionists all ganged up against us. So everybody rallied to us. And that'll make them more powerful. So what we ought to do is finally just quit. Just quit. Now, you ask Ron Paul, he will tell you, just quit. But he also cares about the dead civilians. You know, he's a real humanitarian individualist kind of guy. And he'll tell you, just quit. And it's really shame what America's policy does to the civilians. Look at these people being killed. You know, Scheuer's attitude is American national interests only. And he's saying, we sure as hell should not be backing the Bin Ladenites against Assad. Just because the Israelis hate Iran. But no, we shouldn't be backing Assad either. If he can handle him, he can handle him. But it's not our fight. And by making it our fight, you make it our fight. So just knock it off. But now, can you imagine that idea somehow taking hold in Washington, D.C.? Just quit. You scored 1,000 goals for your enemies the whole time in the war on terror. Just stop. Because, of course, their government. They got a monopoly, and they succeed by failing. The worse they do, the better off they are. And if you told Donald Rumsfeld in 2003, hey, Donald, I'm from the future, and look, here's what's going to happen. He would say, awesome. So what's the problem? You came back to warn me? Ha! You know, it's just good investment advice is all it is, but other than that, appreciate it. That's the way it goes. And it was supposed to be easy. This isn't all just the Yanan plan. The Iraq war was supposed to be easy. Plan B was the Yanan plan. Oh, well. And then look what happened. They ended up losing. Oh, that means the Israeli plan to destroy the whole Middle East and just keep everybody in the smallest political units fighting as possible forever. But what was supposed to happen is the Iraqis weren't even supposed to really exist other than as extras in America's movie over there. We're going to go over there. We're going to put Chalabi in charge. We're going to build 100 bases. We're going to stay forever. We're going to boss everybody around. And it's going to be fine. Except then a massive civil war broke out. America had no choice but to take the side of the majority, which meant fighting a civil war that killed 1 million people and displaced 5 million and destroyed their entire civilization. Completely obliterated all the Chaldean and Assyrian Christians of Iraq, the Druze and the Jews. There were still Jews in Iraq. Actually, last I heard, there were still like 8 Jews in Baghdad somewhere. They may be gone now. There were a few hundred of them in 2003. And we're talking for 2,000 years straight. They lived there. That's how they got there, was in biblical times, you know, coming back from Iran or whatever. Did that really happen? The Jews in Iran and in Persia? Yeah, I guess so, right? And then they came back. Anyway, I don't really know all that biblical stuff very well. But anyway, point being, completely obliterated their society. And led us to this. I got distracted talking about them damn minority groups, all the minority groups of Iraq that ceased to exist. Oh yeah, how easy it was all supposed to be. The idea that you were gonna have a Badr Brigade and a Supreme Islamic Council and a bunch of Zarqawiites and these other guys with their own agendas that could actually affect what America's doing there in our occupation. As Bush put it, bring them on. Who the hell you think you are? But he didn't know that, well, they were the Iraqi army that just got fired. And they had weapons. Anyway, so instead they've reverted back, I guess, to just atomization. Petraeus today in his testimony talked about may have to break Syria up. And there was a follow-up question about that from one of the Republicans. So you're saying there's going to have to be a new independent Eastern Syrian Sunni stan, huh? And he's going, well, I'm only saying not that that was the solution 4 years ago when America started making it this way, but that that now there's been so much sectarian cleansing that that's pretty much a de facto state anyway. But so who's going to replace the Islamic State? Who's going to rule Sunni stan if not Damascus? He didn't have an answer. And certainly didn't acknowledge that this was his idea. You know, he helped to do this in the first place. And then the same Republican said, well, so what about in Iraq? You're saying Iraq can still exist as a unitary state? And he's like, I don't know. You know, his answer was almost, well, I guess that's what I'm supposed to say, but no, not really. I mean, and of course, why is that? It's because he took all the incentives away from both sides for why they needed to deal with each other. Because the American army fought a war for the Shia. Call it a moral hazard. The U.S. Army and Marine Corps being used to kick all the Sunnis out of the capital city. And all the predominantly Shia regions. And then turning right around and doing the surge where he armed up all the Sunni insurgents. And paid them and basically created a separate government out of them for Iraqi Sunnistan. And then he said, now that the cleansing is done, the cleansing, I love how they call it that. Now that the cleansing is done, and now that I've created two separate armed forces for Shiistan and Sunnistan, there, now compromise. And the Shia were like, yeah, right, suck it and go die in the desert, pal, to the Sunnis. We'll break you off nothing. See ya. You lost. And then they told George Bush, now don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And by the way, for your right-wing uncle talking point's sake, Petraeus also conceded today that no, America could not have gotten a status of forces agreement, even no matter how bad Obama tried in 2011 to be allowed to stay. And he did try to stay, but there's no way he could have gotten a status of forces agreement through the parliament. But now what's happened? Petraeus said, look, we've reinvaded Iraq. He didn't use that word. We've reinvaded Iraq. We got 3,500 something there. It's more than that. Without a status of forces agreement, nobody noticed. Hardy har har. He joked. Oh, let me see if I can find that McCain clip of him crying about quit picking on ISIS. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, kiddos, welcome back to the show here. Wrapping up for the day. Let me just say real quick, the IAEA went to Parchin. They got samples. There was no 24 days of the Iranians fighting about it. It's still 2015. And already, the first thing they did was the Parchin inspection. They sent Iranians in there, but they had IAEA cameras on them the whole time, you know, basically waiting outside. However, the swipes were gained according to the process. And you can read all about it at Jason Ditz's thing at news.antiwar.com and about the Syrian cross-contamination, probably deliberate, I don't know. But anyway, it was all according to the book. There's no indication of any explosives or, you know, implosion chamber there, of course. Which, if you believe in the myth of the thing, it would have been very difficult for them to completely dismantle and get rid of without anybody noticing. But anyway, that's very important. And then the war on Yemen continues. It's America's war. Saudi can't do it without us. So it's America's war. Simple as that. It's Obama's war in Yemen right now, and people are dying. And it's horrible. And you know what? They say, hey, there's a blockade. And they import 90% of their food. Or 80% is a more conservative estimate. And there's a war going on. But they've been saying that for 5 months, 6 months. So how many people have starved to death already? Is anybody saying? Does anybody really know? Was it an overblown number of how much food they import? Or do Yemenis all have like a Y2K store of extra storable food in their basement or what? How many people has Obama starved to death there already? Does anyone know or care? I don't know. Anyway, I think here's that clip of John McCain. I'm almost positive this is the part where he's saying we need a no-fly zone and whatever because the problem is not ISIS. The problem is Assad.
And we should own up to that. And some kind of accommodation with Bashar Assad, of course, would fly in the face of everything that the United States of America has ever stood for. So you are calling for in your statement that we tell Bashar Assad to stop the barrel bombs and establish an enclave where people could take refuge, could have protection from the incredible, insane cruelties of Bashar Assad. There's going to be blowback on that. Well, doesn't that mean that we're going to have American boots on the ground? Doesn't that mean we're back in the quagmire? Doesn't that mean I can see the reaction now from some of my friends, who, by the way, the same ones that opposed the surge when they're around. But what's your response to that, General Petraeus, that this would then cause us to be involved with boots on the ground and back into the quagmire that characterized our involvement prior to the surge?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to fast forward it past Petraeus. No, let's listen to Petraeus.
A couple points, if I could, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I think very important to underscore the fact that Bashar al-Assad can't be part of the long-run solution in Syria. He is, as you noted, as I noted, the individual held responsible for well over 200,000, perhaps as high as 250,000 Syrians dead.
Yeah, when 100,000 of those are his army.
He is
but
the
anyway.
Magnetic attraction that is bringing jihadis to Syria to fight him. And if we are to support a force, it won't work for us. It won't be supportable if we don't support it against Bashar al-Assad's actions against it, the most horrific of which are the dropping of barrel bombs, and that can be stopped. We have the capability to do that. We don't have to put 165,000 troops on the ground to do that. We don't have to put any boots on the ground to do that, although I think at some point in an enclave, we should not be closed to the possibility of some advisors or support elements being in something like that in the same way that we have them on the ground in Iraq. So I don't see this as the entering a quagmire. I see this as taking out the most horrific casualty-producing item. I think General Allen has said that well over 50% of the casualties overall in Syria have been caused by these indiscriminate
barrel bombs. Maybe we should sell them some JDAMs,
at a moment's notice drop from the sky. We have the capability to stop that, and we should.
Speaking of Russia, I noted that the Russians have aircraft that are primarily as interceptors, not close air support. ISIS doesn't have an air force. It's very interesting. And what is your assessment of what Vladimir Putin is trying to accomplish with this incredible buildup in Syria, and what should the United States do in response?
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at this writ large. I think that what Vladimir Putin would like to do is resurrect the Russian Empire. You see this in a variety of different activities, or at least the Soviet Union. He has a number of different activities, diplomatic, economic, and, of course, military, in a variety of countries around Russia. And now he is, of course, in Syria as well, and trying to revive Russian relationships with countries in the Middle East. I think the immediate objective that he has in Syria is to solidify the corridor on the Mediterranean coast between Latakia, where he has his air base, and Tartus, where they have the Russian naval base, the only naval base left in the Mediterranean. Clearly, he would like to shore up his ally, Bashar al-Assad. At the very least, he wants to make sure that Bashar is not thrown under the bus by either other regime members or perhaps even Iran until at least he has some better sense of the way forward. His objective is to keep that naval base and, indeed, to keep the air base that is also useful for solidifying it and that corridor. I would think beyond that, he wants to help Bashar solidify his grip, which has been challenged increasingly in recent months by ISIS and then by other opposition forces as well, that runs from the coast to Homs and then down to Damascus, and so that he can at least keep a rump Syrian state. But again, as I said, Assad cannot be part of the long-run solution, but as I also said, we should not be quick to oust Assad until we have some sense of what will follow him.
I think that statement right there, the way he says it, is a pretty direct repudiation of John McCain's position, actually. I don't know if it was meant that way or not. But anyway, I'm sorry to subject you to all this, but I'm trying to get that good soundbite where McCain starts really protesting, and I think maybe it starts right now.
So the United States, in the short term, should do what in regards to this, in response to this significant military buildup?
Well, the first is we should not go in league with this. We should not think that we can partner with Russia and Iran and Bashar al-Assad against ISIS. Again, if Russia wanted to fight ISIS, they could have joined the 60-plus member coalition that General Allen has so capably put together and helped drop bombs on ISIS. They have some capabilities that would be useful to that fight. So this is clearly not what they're up to. And we have to be very clear in our resolve to ensure that we deter action by Russia that would involve any of the forces we're supporting, and certainly anything
sorry,
that we're doing
man.
In that.
I'll get my damn John McCain soundbite later. Yeah, no, all they're trying to do is prop up their client satellite state, which means prop it up in protection from the Islamic State. But yeah, no, but if they didn't join our coalition to do that, then that must not be what they're up to. I mean, screw Russia. Obviously, they're interested in preserving their client and expanding their own power and influence, but I sit here and listen to Petraeus tell me that, and I'd still get it wrong. Anyway, I'll get the great soundbite, the McCain soundbite for you. I thought maybe I'd be lucky enough to cue it up to the part where he's really sputtering mad and saying, ISIS isn't the problem. Assad is the problem. Barrel bombs, barrel bombs. Yeah. Like America doesn't do airstrikes and bomb civilians every day, including in Syria. But anyway, whatever. It's just a matter of making a thin excuse. Not really making an actual point. By the way, you know, I read a thing in Reuters that was saying, let's see if I can find it, saying pretty much that the coup in Burkina Faso had failed, I think, that basically the coup leader was still insisting he was the boss, but nobody was doing what he said, so I don't know how it was he wasn't arrested yet exactly, but where the hell did it go? I had it here. Yeah. Anyway, sorry for wasting that whole segment. Go to antiwar.com today. There's a ton of great news there. And especially catch up on Yemen. It's one of the most horrible and most underreported stories going on in the world right now. I'll try my best to do something about that for you later this week. See you tomorrow.